Welcome to Crosstalk, the number one podcast this side of the sun. I'm Corey Rabin. Thanks for joining us today. We're here to offer you hope and support on your journey in recovery from addiction. Whether you're sober or thinking about making a change, we're here for you. Each episode, we try to do a deep dive into the story of people who've had success in recovery and also from clinicians and therapists and people who offer support to the recovery community, life coaches, therapists, and doctors. Sometimes we have authors on our podcast, but everything we do is intended to try to provide support to the recovery community. What we want to do here is navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories, and victories there are. So I want you to open your minds, open your hearts, and let's take this ride together on Crosstalk. Today, we have a terrific guest, somebody who's been through quite a bit. He's going to tell you all about it. A little bit different than our typical podcast interview because Rich Pagano comes at things from a little bit of a different side as a parent from a child who had an addiction. Rich will tell you all about his son, Nick. Rich will inspire us to do better things. And I'm really happy that he's here with us today. Please help me welcome Rich Pagano.
Thanks for having me, Corey. Grateful to be here.
Welcome, Rich. Thanks so much for being here. Let's get started. Where do you want to start?
Sure. I was born in Brooklyn, raised on Long Island in a town called West Babylon. Wonderful parents. Spent most of my childhood just loving art and music. Played drums for a long time, still do. Went to art school as an illustrator, moved on and was sort of juggling sessions in New York City and club drumming and all kinds of gigs, and eventually realized that my love truly was in music and writing music and producing and playing music, and went full-time back into the entertainment business. And these days, I have a recording studio, which was in Manhattan for 25 years. Now it's upstate New York. And when I'm not drumming, I'm producing music or mixing or writing with people. I'm grateful that I'm, you know, in a business that is fleeting these days, you know, the music business, with, we all know what's happening with digital music not making much money and everybody needing to go on the road, that I'm able to stay afloat by having a few irons in the fire. I do a lot of music directing, mainly for benefit events, and I'm grateful for that. And the only way to really feel, fulfilled is to wear many hats these days and not really stay in one place. And so that's my life.
And after you got your education, that sort of time where you got married, how old were you when you got married?
Mid-30s. But my wife Karen, who I love dearly, we were together for a long time before that. Lived in the city together, and I was on the road for a while and then decided to take a break, and we had a child, Nicholas, born in 2000.
Had life changed my Nicholas at all?
My blinders came off. I was and still am so driven to create. Life is somewhat meaningless to me if I'm not creating. I shouldn't say meaningless, that it's hard for me to compartmentalize my life with my loving relationship and my work and then creativity without the creative component. But the child comes into it. And I feared that I would be selfish, and it all changed when I saw our son, and that creative energy went into nurturing a child. Fears were unfounded. And I was, it took me a long time to want to delve into being a father. I had a lot of ideas and plans, and I thought that you really can't keep both roads running or moving when you have a child in the picture. But certainly wasn't the case. And it, well, we only had one child, so, you know, I could strap him on and bring him anywhere. So it was just wonderful. And, you know, and I know we'll get into it, but I'm grateful, even though, you know, we no longer have him in our lives. I'm grateful that I was a father for 20 years.
Did there come a point, teenage years, where Nicholas started foray into things with drugs, alcohol, things like that? Were you all aware of the path when that began?
Well, I was aware of it almost immediately because of maybe the amount of time we spent together and just how close we were, the difference in his personality. But, you know, we always knew that we had a spirited child who, Nicholas was gay. And although he didn't come out until his teen years, he had some sexual identity issues when he was young that created anxiety and a bit of depression. But we were very proactive with a wonderful therapist. And eventually Nick became an actor and had a level of success in acting. And he was able to get beside himself as an actor. And it also created a wonderful endorphin rush for him to become a character. But unfortunately, in the early days with THC, that filled the same portal as his acting endorphin. And one day he came to me when I found weed in his room. He was 14. And I said, there's no drug use in this family. And he said, but I feel good. I like myself when I smoke weed. And I get the same feeling and satisfaction that I get when I'm acting, when I smoke weed, that I get when I'm acting, except I don't have to learn a script that thick. And I said to him, that's a crutch that's not going to work for you. Unfortunately, in a matter of months, he moved on to pills, Xanax, Oxys, whatever he can get his hands on. And it became a bit of a communal situation with, you know, friends that, because of his anxiety and self-doubt, all of his acting friends were moving away. But his friends that were feeling compromised emotionally, compromised by their, I would say, similar conditions, anxiety, levels of self-doubt, also finding pills and weed as the answer. The next thing you know, you're coming home from work and there's a party in the bedroom.
So everybody that Nick had left were people also who were doing the same things, going to the same places, hanging out with these people.
And well, in the sort of actor community, yeah, they I can't say that they were not partaking in smoking weed, but when it got to pills, we weren't seeing those friends anymore. We were seeing a different type of friend. You know, there was a kindred spirit on another level. Suddenly, you know, he's not going to school, and I'm finding him on the rooftop smoking weed alone, which is a red flag. It's about 14, 15 at this point. And it excelled into, you know, of course, coming down from pills the next morning is a pretty miserable person. And it starts getting volatile. You start yelling. And a child runs out of the house. And you find a therapist, you find an outpatient program, because you can't imagine that your child is going to have to go into rehab. You know, we knew nothing, you know. It was all foreign to us. Of course, I'm sure we could talk about this when we get into the parental aspect. Most parents, like we did, go into the aspect of, or the angle of, we've done everything right. How could he? How could she? So that's where we were. How dare you act this way when I this and this and this with you, and we had this, and I instilled in you these fundamentals, and we love each other. How dare you? So it creates a lot of tension in the house. But of course, eventually, your child isn't waking up in the morning to go to school, and you have to step it up, and that's where treatment had to come in. I think in our case, it was a triple C was big for a while there, the Robitussin, where I think about 12 Robitussin pills was equal to like a low-dose Oxy.
Robitussin is codeine?
An over-the-counter cough medicine, yeah. I guess there's a level of codeine in there. Has to be, actually, right? So we were advised at that point to get him into a 30-day program. And he was young enough to listen to us and understand our concern. And that was the only time where getting our son into a program was not very difficult. We got into the car, and we drove out to Caron Treatment Center. Of course, when he got there and saw everyone else in the program and their volatile emotional state and not necessarily in the group rooms, but maybe other people coming in, he looked at us with like, what am I doing here as we're leaving? And that was the beginning of treatment. He had been in therapy for many years because of potential gender dysphoria issue, which was unfounded. I think also our son was, when he was trying to understand his own sexuality, he was very envious of women, girls. And I think there was a time there where he felt, why can't I be like them? And, and it's very common, when you're trying to figure out who you are, where you've come from, if anyone believes in, past lives and who you were then and what appears in this life and how you navigate through it. But it was difficult for him, and it added to his anxieties. And we don't have to get into that too much. I mean, that has nothing to do with having the switch. But it became a perfect cocktail in sexual identity issues, ego, an incredibly large natural ego, anxiety, depression, and a substance use disorder. That's, there's the time bomb right there. There are plenty of kids who go through what Nick went through that don't have a substance use disorder. Add that neural pathway, that super wide needs to be filled, and that's what we had. But we were very proactive.
You also had a great amount of talent and success. People were telling you how terrific he was.
But what's interesting is he never believed it. We were, my wife Karen, very close with Nick. They were very similar in personality too, very impulsive personalities, very sensitive, emotions on their sleeves. I think me being a bit mellower, Nick would notice me and sort of maybe wonder, like, I see how he's getting through, when life is tough. And I think he admired that. But he also was with me in, at my performances. And sometimes I'd be on the road with some people that would fill venues. And I would have to, when he would say to me, look at these people love you. And I said, I'm lucky that I get to play music and make people feel happy. But what I do is just a job. I made it very clear to him. This is no different than your grandfather who is a hairstylist or your mother who manages an art gallery. This is just a job. Just my job brings people in and they dance and sing and they're very happy. But I think that when he started getting leads and plays, for some reason, he felt he couldn't maintain that. And I don't know if it had anything to do with the pedestal he put me on, which was false, in my opinion, of course. But that's how a young mind thinks. I felt the same way about my dad. My dad picked up drumsticks one day. I want to be a drummer. It's just, if you're tight with your dad and your mom, you know, you become a sponge. So he suddenly sees people giving him all the accolades after a show and flowers. And I'll never forget when, so at first it was children's theater, then it was sort of an off-Broadway workshop thing. He eventually was on Law and Order in bit parts. But when he had these wonderful leads in plays and everyone surrounded him afterwards, because he always got the lead, he would take the hugs and the kisses and the flowers and then come over to me and say, let's get out of here. And I would say, what? They want to hang with you. They want to talk about, you know, this is also part of it. Hanging with, I'll wait and go backstage and talk about the performance. No, let's get out of here. And I found that odd then. But it was a natural self-doubt. It's just...
it's also a reflection of the fact that as much as he didn't want to do that, he also wanted to connect with you.
Or how can I... And I don't say this as something that I surmised, but, you know, I found out later that, through his therapist, that he would say, how can I ever attain what my parents did? You know, my wife is a successful gallery director, and I've had some success in the music business, you know, and it's no matter how much you can tell your child regarding, oh, it's really just what I do for a living. It's a giant mountain. And for Nick, it was, I don't see myself. He had identity issues, and it sort of clouded his path, or to compartmentalize a road to here to here to here. Up and up and up. And he made it very clear later on, you know, that, you know, I don't know how I could ever make you proud of me. I don't know where that came from, because we were always, you know, flooding him with how proud we were. We were strict parents also. But it's the disease coupled with these mental health issues that, you know, you eventually become to understand. And then you change your approach, which we did, and which I think, and we can talk about it, that I think helped keep Nick alive for an additional 18 months when he was deep in the throes of his disorder.
So about what age are we in terms of your relationship and Carolyn's relationship with Nick or the same?
It's about 16 now. I mean, so we've gone through a couple of years of... well, there was Karen for 30 days and then an outpatient program in New York City. When it was just weed, we would say, okay, be responsible, be respectful, do your homework, let's move ahead. But it, of course, didn't stay there. Went right back to pills, and unfortunately moved on to heroin. And that was a game changer. It's like nothing you could ever imagine if you've been living for 2 years in mainly pills and weed. The personality changed. It was no longer a volatile personality. It was a mellow personality, but with fear of how this narcotic made him feel. I'll never forget when I wasn't sure if he was doing anything else, we would find him in bed with us, sitting up, nodding, but needing to be in the middle of us, because he was so afraid of what he was feeling and needed to have a level of comfort and safety and stability. And I would say, what are you doing in here? And he would come out of it. I just want to hang with you guys. And he'd go back in. And then I was notified, there's something more going on here. He's snorting. And we were still young and dumb with the whole thing. And we said, let's make sure he finishes summer school, and then we'll get him into treatment again. And he finished summer school, and on that last day, he starts, Karen calls me and says, he's got needle marks in his arms. And I rush home from a gig, but I come home, and he's nodding out. And I guess at 11 o'clock at night, we said, let's just call a treatment center that was recommended, and this time far away from New York, Huntington Beach. Let's get him out there. Got him right on a flight, middle of the night, flew him out there. He's crying. He realizes that this is like nothing he ever imagined. You know, it was new to him. He was only months into it, into the use of heroin. And that was the last he had ever been home. I had came home one time after a sober living situation, but relapsed almost immediately. And that was, I guess, about 17. And it had been a series of treatment centers and sober homes and getting him off the street for from 17 through 20.
This is what year were you in?
2017, yeah.
17, he begins that process.
Yeah.
So up till 2020 or so.
Yeah. To 2021, sorry. Born in 2000, so I always go, it's easy to go from 17 through 21. And, you know, embraced the 12 steps, became incredibly knowledgeable on the process of sobriety and sort of analyzing the 12 steps and bringing in the human condition. I mean, he and I spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the meaning of God and the energy of God, God as an energy within you. And when he was young, my wife would say to me, I was raised Catholic, but my father took us out of the church at a very young age. My wife was raised Jewish, but was never really religious. But I had a strong sort of foundation and set of parameters on what I felt God energy was. And behavioral patterns that religion, I felt, tried to instill before science. And I spent a lot of time talking to Nick about that. So he eventually embraced what AA was about and how invoking God meant. And he got it. Emotionally, it was a whole other story, of course. You know, intellectually, he was there. And not to move ahead, but I mean, in 2021, Nick was sober for 6 months. It was incredible because now you have your son back. And I used to say, one time I said to him, when he would call me from treatment apologizing for whatever had just happened, I said, I know you're in there. And he said, why would you say that, Dad? It's all me. I said, no, it's not. Behind your eyes, I see you. But when you're using, that's another part of your brain. That's a whole other entity that I had to negotiate. And I live to see you in there. And right now on the phone with you, I'm talking to you. He got mad at me, but I think he understood. But for those 6 months, he came out. There he was for 6 months. And he's struggling. He's having a hard time. He's got, you know, he was, you know, a very thin kid. He's struggling with weight gain now because he's purging. He's finding other ways, you know. But he then, he was in a really wonderful place, Greater Boston Treatment's Addiction Center, which had a really wonderful mix of young adults. He was going mainly in the New England area. He had been all over the country. But by 2018 through 21, mainly stayed in the New England area. But in this place, in Boston, they were able to sort of take the piss out of each other, but they knew why they were there. And they accepted him and his knowledge. And he was a very intelligent kid, very articulate also, and also ruled the room as an actor when he had to, you know, get on his soapbox. And he, you know, we sat for lunch in June of 2021, and he said, I want to go to school. He had just gotten his equivalency, high school. I want to go to school, and I want to become a licensed social worker, and I want to specialize on intake of the LGBTQ community. I looked over at Karen, and I said, there he is. There's our son. Unfortunately, 3 weeks later, he had 72 hours of a compromised state of mind and went to the street. But I guess my point is that he knew the process. And one other thing, if we can maybe bring it over to the parental side, is that we became pro, Karen and I. You know, even though I'm a certified sober coach, my wife has decided to stay on the outside. It's too triggering for her to stay in the trenches of recovery. Everyone has their process. But my wife knows as much as I do about this condition because we were always in it together. Great sober coaches. I think that whenever I speak to parents, I always start the meeting by saying, if it's a new meeting, I know what you're saying. It didn't work out so well for me. Why would you listen to me? You know, but I think that by us becoming pro in those last 18 months of his life, we were able to prolong his life, meaning that we really started to understand, which is going to be my quote, which is, respond, don't react. You asked about a quote before. There are better quotes out there, but that one always seems to resonate with me.
So we're in the summer of July of 2021.
Yeah, spring.
Spring of 2021. He's doing well. We lose him.
Right. Actually, yes, summer. But what I wanted to add was, I think what it the relationship, sometimes, as you know, he's hating me. He's hating Karen. And we began to accept this, you know, whatever. It has nothing to do with us. You know, we are there with him. We're visiting him. COVID was a drag. Not being able to see him, visit him, was detrimental to his mental health because we were such a close family. But Zoom worked. He relapsed a lot during COVID. And also, he was over at Turnbridge. And he had gone through the three stages at Turnbridge. And when you get to the third stage, you're allowed to get a bus pass. You're allowed to get a part-time job. You're allowed to have a social life. You know, you're not under, you know, under the roof constantly or under, you know, the watchful eye.
But not during COVID.
Just pre-COVID. So he gets to stage three. He sets out to try to get him a job. Meetings every night. There's also a whole new level of meetings. The meetings are no longer only in church basements, he finds out, or, you know, certain halls in New York City. And Nick would come home and say to me in the early days, it's a bunch of old guys and me, Dad. Why do I have to go to these meetings? And, you know, what can I say? You know, this is the process. There weren't a lot of young people for some reason when he was 15 and 16 going to these meetings, or maybe we didn't know about. We weren't sort of like branching out to find the right meetings. We sent him to meetings in our neighborhoods, which tended to be older people. Anyway, so now he finds this community of kids that are having meetings, fellowship meetings in the back of Starbucks, you know, and suddenly he's a social butterfly again for the first time in 3 years. And he's feeling liberated. He's like, I can do this. He's sober for a few months. COVID comes. He goes back into that dark place because he can't hang. He's sequestered to the common room in the sober house or his bedroom. Hard to go anywhere. No meetings together. Hated Zoom meetings. So yeah, COVID was tough. But now, like moving ahead to 2021 in the spring, he's sober. He's having a hard time. We are now approaching him with an attitude of, like I said, responding, not reacting. And staying with our acronyms, the WAIT acronym, why am I talking? And finding that he just wants to spew. We don't have to respond to him all the time. We can validate more. We're learning all of these textbook approaches that parents need to know when they have a child or a sibling, you know, a brother and sister in the throes. And understanding that the safety net is not going to be what it was. And I'll never forget this one when he was in Huntington Beach and he relapsed, living on the beach for a week. And our sober coach said, three rules. When he calls you from the beach, three questions. Are you safe? Yes. Do you have our number or someone's number in your wallet or in your pocket in case something happens to you and someone needs to be called? Yes. Call us when you decide to return to treatment. Click. So, of course, the first 3 days you get, I'm just want to hear your voice. That's him. Are you safe? Yes. Do you have a phone number in your pocket? No, but I will. Call us when you are ready to go back to treatment, as the phone is moving away from your ears. Fuck you! And all the volatile things that come out, click, and you feel like you're being broken in half. And the second call now, same thing, except before the phone's being hung up, my wife would chime in with, are you eating? I had to look at her like, you're not supposed to go there. We have to get tough. We can't, our compassion beyond what we're being taught is actually an endorphin rush for this boy. We can't, the endorphin rush has to come from his community, not from us right now on that level. We can't give him the concern for the endorphin rush on that level. Are you eating? Are you, do you have your shoes? Forget about those questions. Let's stay with these. By the fifth day, it's blah, 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 number two. Then the third one, call us when you want to go back to treatment. All right, goodbye from him, right? And of course, on the seventh or eighth day, whatever it was, it's call us when you want to go back to treatment. I'm ready to go back to treatment. So it went from such a volatile scene for so many days to my parents are not giving me what I need, so I'm not going to be that person with them. And that was a big awakening for us, to shift down, to not give more than we really need to. It's so difficult because you want to nurture. You want to ask questions. You know, my wife, you know, she's incredible with the way she can draw communication out of him. With he and I, it was, we don't feel like talking, we'll just hang and watch a movie, whatever. But she's very, her mother's the same way, very conversive, and it's wonderful.
It must have been torture for her to go through that rigorous of that limited content.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so hard to watch the effect on her. But I'm in it too, you know, so we're in it together. So anyway, I think that now cut to 2021, and we now know exactly when to shift down and also when not to answer questions. If it certainly pertains to what the therapist should be answering, I think that you should ask the therapist that question. You know, of course, some early conversations were, no, you should be answering me. I'm not qualified to. I'm not comfortable, of course, starting with the eyes. I tell parents all the time, always start with the eyes. I'm not comfortable with your tone. I'm not comfortable answering that right now. I'd like 10 minutes. I. Never the yous, never the pejoratives. You shouldn't, you whatever. That always would get us in trouble, especially with a kid who's volatile or under the influence where the fire is always coming out. So what I'm saying is I'm very proud that that whole period in 2021, at our final meeting with his therapist, he said, how'd you get so pro? You know?
And by that, how did you get so good at something that's so difficult?
Yes. Yeah. How did you learn how to not give me what I thought I needed from you, which made me in turn do an about face to my community, which he was doing an incredible amount of work with his sponsor, Sober Coach, joining another fellowship up there with all of his young kids, and also, you know, getting into his phone and you know, feeling like we want him to be sexual and maybe meet somebody. All these emotions that come out that aren't going towards going to the street. And unfortunately, there was 1 week where he put a video up of a daily affirmation, and the daily affirmation, it may have been partly in theater performance on some level, but it was, my sober coach is telling me that I need to do a daily affirmation. So here it goes. You're a fucking dirty drug addict, and you'll amount to nothing. Looking in the camera. That was his last video. I asked his friend about that, and she said, I saw that. I wish he didn't post it, but I think she said when I spoke to him about it, he kind of played it as, I just wanted to be so provocative. But you know, there was some truth to how he was feeling, because it was right before he met somebody in a meeting who he had relapsed with at Turnbridge. Suddenly she's in Boston. She's living on her own. and she's using. He didn't know at the time. But, you know, they rekindle the friendship. She's got acid at her house. She tells him. He's suddenly having a bad week, goes, do a couple of tabs. Portal's open. Goes back next couple of nights later. She's now asking him for money. Turns into that whole thing. Then they go to the street, meet the dealer. And she then says to him, you can't use in my house. She knew you haven't used for 6 months. He goes back to the sober house and uses on his own, just snorting. Minuscule amount of fentanyl. Not even heroin, by the way. Ripped off. Tramadol laced with heroin, laced with fentanyl. Had the wherewithal to put the packet back in his wallet so his roommate wouldn't see it or find it in his backpack. Put himself to bed. You always see, I mean, you see videos of cops being taken down immediately. They go into the trunk and they pat down what's in there and the dust of the fentanyl comes up. Cop goes right down. They got to be revived. It was so minuscule, he put himself to bed. But he's very pure at that point. Taken any of us down. But I'm grateful to see that, you know, the steps ahead that he took in sobriety and understanding it. And also, I'm very proud of how my wife and I eventually approached him and how that helped him turn around and face his community, which he adored. These girls love, they couldn't, the amount of letters that I got from, because Nick, you know, he was still intimidated by male energy at that point. You know, he hasn't really had his sexual relationship yet. But he loved being around girls, you know, and they loved him. They felt very safe with him. It was wonderful that he found his friends, you know.
I got sober in 1982. I had a relapse in 2014-ish. A little foggy for me about what day that was, with pain medication. But in the 42 years or so, 40 of which, approximately, I've lived as a sober man, I've really never run into any name that has highlighted love and concern and helping others as your son's name. Nick's name has become synonymous with helping LGBTQ plus addicts and alcoholics in recovery. There's a foundation. I want you to talk a little bit about what that's all about. He was a lightning rod. His name is a lightning rod. And you and Karen are a lightning rod for helping other people. And while he's not here with us, he's here with us. I believe that that's the case. And he's doing a lot of good for other people. And his, who he was and what you and Karen have done during your lives, done a lot of really good things. So I like this, even though it's sad. Also, look at the positive side of what you guys have done in order to create some good out of the experience. I mean, everything that happens in life doesn't work out the way we want it to work out. But if we learn something from what's happened, that's as much as we can hope for. Because, you know, my mother said she stole this, I'm sure. She said, you know, if things don't work out the way you want them to, it's not the end. And I'm botching the phrase. You always have the opportunity to use it for something good. Talk a little bit about, you know, what you and Karen have done to be able to take some good from this unfortunate period of time in your life and the end.
You're lucky that you had a mother who communicated in that way. You know, those things stay with the child. You know, my father said things that resonated with me. My father left us many years ago, but similar. Said the right things, you know. It certainly makes a big difference.
I think the exact phrase, by the way, is in the end, it's all going to be okay. Yeah. It's not okay, it's not the end, something like that.
Yeah.
That's what I grew up with this. It's really about the end.
Well, I think getting back to that luncheon that we spoke about, when Nick said, I want to specialize on intake in the LGBTQ plus community, he said, then it was a transgender kid, like I said, in his sober house. And he said, Dad and Mom, in the gay community, the transgender don't get much respect. There's a separation there, you know. And he says, you know, I want to do something about that. And by coincidence, Karen Treatman booked the Fab Four at a gala that year. And no one involved, maybe one person knew Nick from when he was at Karen Treatman. He was there twice, actually, 30-day programs. But only maybe one person remembered him. And Nick had gone to Release Recovery, which we also should talk about. You know, Zach's incredible organization. And when he was there, although he did relapse, he made a lot of progress at that sober house. They had a lot of philosophies that resonated with Nick up there in Yorktown Heights. So we do the I go into contract with Karen Treatman to do this event here in New York City, and I start talking about Nick, especially with Todd Whitmer at Karen, and he knows what we're going through with our son. And then the next conversation is, Todd, we lost Nick. Todd knew about Nick and his passion for his community. And I think that Todd then went to, at that time, Zach and Justin and said, we all know what Nick was about to embark on. Let's talk to Rich and Karen about a foundation. And they called us back and said, we'd like to start the Nick Pagano LGBTQIA plus Scholarship for Recovery. And we'll set aside a whole program, create a program at Karen Treatman out in Pennsylvania. We had just lost him now. So I said, of course, this is how his energy will live on. I don't know how I'm going to feel about it, but I can't say no to this now. You know, we did the event. And then the crux of the event became about my son, and not necessarily a memoriam to him, but it just the plight of this community. And then we performed. It's incredible how this happened. I then wanted to sort of remain in the trenches with this organization, and like I said, became a certified sober coach. It gave me a clear path. Or just made me see where I should go in the future with this and helping parents. But besides being a sober coach, I'm also a band leader. I also contract for events. I know how to create shows. I have friends that I toured with, some A-level performers that knew our son. I reached out to everybody. I said, I really want to have an incredible gala. I don't say gala. I want to have a concert. The Karen Treatman over at Cipriani's, that's a gala. I want a concert. It has to be, being that my audience tend to be, you know, music people, pop, you know, but there has to be an LGBTQ element. So now I'm just trying to find out, you know, how to get different departments to come in with talent, asking Todd to reach out to some alumnus, agents, or managers. So in the first year, we had Roseanne Cash, Marshall Crenshaw, Rachel Yamagata, Kate Pearson from the B-52s. I know I'm leaving people out, but it was an incredible sold-out show. We made enough scholarships for, I think, five recoveries. And we just did another one this year, similar outcome. And I hope to build this to be at the Beacon Theater someday. And it's very difficult to get people, artists, to commit early on because no one knows their schedule, but I can't not do it. And then I go out there and I talk to the faculty and how grateful they are that they're able to facilitate a very specific program of inclusion, information, and how the parents are being taught to navigate through a very different process, because we're at a 20% higher rate of kids in the LGBTQ community either overdosing or committing suicide due to their disease, the effects of their disease, because they run away from treatment. And this is sort of creating a normal platform, which is what we're really trying to do, is normalize it.
Well, it's a risky place for everybody, and it's particularly risky when people in that community are potentially like the militaristic guy in New England that you were talking about, who's supposed to be there supporting people, are actually there, you know, enhancing the likelihood of, you know, not doing well.
And as you know, that kid who is, you know, angry and just needs to be a bully, and has a lot to do with, you know, his or her condition. And I think that I think it's very important. I mean, you know, this is a whole other conversation. You know, we have, you know, there are certain factions in this country that are pouncing on this LGBTQ movement to make it not necessarily relevant, but like I said, to normalize it, to just sort of flatline it so it's as easy to digest as someone having blonde hair. But somehow being different on that level angers a group of people, or it makes for good news. It makes for, you know, I was in the advertising business for a long time, industry for a long time. The fact that you see certain networks, certain news networks, spending so much time on a philosophy of indoctrination of young kids, which is not happening, that you're just seeing more and more groups sort of propping up the LGBTQ community for one reason, just to make it more normal. No one is trying to infiltrate anyone else's life with that. But the networks are putting this fear into people. And it makes it difficult for people like us who are trying to make this more relevant. And I have to tell you, there are some people that will respond to our post and say, you know, how did they become gay? You know, like, what did the parents do? People just are uninformed that it's as natural as being heterosexual, or that a substance use disorder is a disease. So I get some blowback on our organization by people that just don't understand, or are just being so influenced by these news shows that have one motive in mind: to keep that person sitting in front of that television to make it through the Viagra commercial or the vacuum commercial, to be back and watch the next segment, to make it through the next commercial so the advertisers are happy. It's all about advertising dollars. But what's happening is the people that are not informed are sitting there thinking that this is reality. These people are trying to push this gay agenda down our throats. And it's really bringing us down.
All they want to do really is just to live and be at peace and fit in.
They're not hurting anybody.
Right.
They're not ransacking stores.
No, as you're talking about a variety of different subjects, you're jumping around a little bit, and I'm glad you are. The one adjective that comes to mind about pretty much everything you do is courage. You know, you don't sit and watch. You're not on the sidelines watching ping pong matches, you know, following the ball, going back and forth. You're in the middle of everything. And I think that's one of the things that Nick admired in you and wanted to aspire to, which is to get in and do something about stuff that you see isn't right.
Well, let me just throw in there that for a while, I am especially busy now. And for a while, I thought it was, I lost my son. I need distractions. I can't sit in it. I have to keep running. And as time goes on, I see it as, you know, it's an energy that is put in front of me to grasp and run with. There's a reason for these energies and these strong emotions to hover in front of me because I'm supposed to pull at them. I'm supposed to grab them and do something with it. So it's more than just the need to sort of check out with distractions. I need a level of that too. I mean, I always tell people, you know, that, well, I don't go to grief meetings anymore, but we all have that one thing in common where there's a black ball of hair at the left side of my eye always. And that's my grief saying, who gives a shit what good things you're doing? Your son's no longer with us. But then on the right side, I have this bright light. And that's where all of these elements you're talking about live. And I wake up in the morning and I go, all right, let's deal with that one today. Let's deal with that one today. And then I go upstate and I sit in my garden and there's a certain place where I hear him. And I just hear, and it could be my father, could be my mother's, my mother's father, could be my father's father, people that, you know, a level of guardian angel, that I keep hearing the same thing. Take care of your wife. Keep moving ahead. And that's all I need. And I'm, you know, I also find that with the grief, I have to audibly say, nope, too much work to do, fuck off. And it dissipates. But so many parents live in guilt. And there's somehow an energy in guilt and grief, an energy that kind of makes you feel alive. But to me, that it's wrong to grab that energy. There's so many parents that were in the grief meetings that would feel, but it's a feeling. Grief is a feeling. And sometimes I want to hold on to it because it's closest to the energy of the feeling I had of being a parent. And I go, oh, that's so the wrong path. But who am I to say? That's your process. No, grief is a memory and hallucination. And memory and hallucinations are behind your ears, behind your blinders. And you're constantly, I always tell parents, even in the throes of what I went through, it's like, you get so angry at your child. It's a disease. You have every right to be angry. But ask yourself, why are you so angry at this child? Is it because of how they're making you feel? And why do you feel that way? Well, because when I was a kid, there it is. So your parents said something to you, or you were marginalized on the ball field or whatever, and you're sort of feeling, you're not feeling empowered as a parent, because parenting can make you feel so empowered, like nothing else. You're no longer feeling empowered. And that's coming into how you are navigating through your child's disorder. It has nothing to do with you. You have to get rid of that. You have to understand, compartmentalize your childhood issues, and now be a pro-parent of a child with a substance use disorder. It's a very different process than the typical parent who has a kid that just goes through all the other bullshit things that we go through as parents, but doesn't have the switch of a disorder. So let's get rid of, and I'm not, you know, therapists can tell them this, but I can also tell them this because I made all the mistakes. Get rid of how it makes you feel and create your boundaries. Keep compassion and love in there with these boundaries. And you have a better chance of your child saying, I don't want to lose this with my parents. And things turn around. And you're not reacting as much.
What I love about that is you're not denying that bad, the left side existing. You're just making a choice to focus on the right things, to focus on the things that are more useful, that are productive, that will do something, maybe to help the next person, and also make it so you can get through each day.
And you made a good point right there. I had a friend the other day who I told what I'm about to tell you to, and she said to me, that must be exhausting. And it is, but it's become a way of life. I have to reassess. For me to stay out of the darkness of losing our son, which is still a very difficult part of our life. I mean, it's a difficult energy. You wake up to it. You go to bed with it. You every 10 minutes. But I feel that when I reassess my life in this way, I have boundary. I have blinders on, and I'm looking only to 2 minutes ahead. If I have a bad moment and the hallucinations and the memories are just permeating and they're just surrounding me. And they're I call them it's a 1,000-pound weight. I go to my blinders and I ask myself, what is wrong right now? Let's see, what is right at the moment? I'm going to assess it right now. It's a beautiful day in New York. I have dinner plans with my wife. I'm sitting in front of a person that has so much knowledge and is doing an incredibly virtuous program here that helps people who I admire. Probably volunteering your time to set this beautiful setup for us to impart our knowledge. I'm meeting with a grandparent later to try to help them through the process. What is wrong with this moment? What is wrong right now? The air in here is beautiful. There's nothing wrong right now. I come out of it. I cannot live beyond more than 5 minutes of my life. And sometimes I will assess it and say, you were nasty to that person this morning. Make the phone call. Settle it. And then nothing is wrong. But if I think of like my future without a child, or why didn't I let him come home? Because at one point, I know we're all over the map here, at one point he left treatment and he got on a train and he's heading to our house. I don't do drugs. I don't drink. I had a heart attack 6 years ago, part from hereditary issues and partly because I was with my wife chasing him around the country. I was stressed out, spending all of our money on treatment. I had a heart attack. I mean, a whole idea of him thinking that I could be his savior, you know, and parents think that I speak to will always feel like I got so far with him until he or she was a teenager. Why is my parenting no longer working?
Not understanding the disease. So they want to be able to fix everything. And then when your kid falls down and scrapes his knee, you want to put the stuff on the knee and make it so it gets all better. I used to call myself Dr. Daddy to my kids. You know, when they were little and they'd get a scrape or whatever, you know, Dr. Daddy will fix it.
Yeah.
Dr. Daddy can't fix anything. But the nice thing is, what you described about sitting in your quiet place where either one of your folks or your grandparents or Nick appears when you're in that space. I have lost many people because I'm old at this point. But I find that as time goes on, the things that are sad about them not being with me somehow get diminished very slowly, and I start recalling the good things, and they're kind of in here. I feel them in here, and I talk to them, and even though I may not utter a word that anyone else can hear, I know what they would tell me, what they would say. I know what kind of support and love I would get from those people, and it's comforting. And, you know, sometimes it's sad, and sometimes it's, you know, you really want it a different way, but, you know, it doesn't go that way, you know, it's not the way things are, but I do feel it.
And I have to be careful. Sometimes in groups, I could tell there are parents that, you know, they don't believe in these type of energies for whatever reason, pessimism or, you know, their religious parameters.
They're not ready.
But they have every right to feel those, you know, when you're dead, you're dead. I've had revelations, and I do feel that. I feel strongly about it. It's all I have left is to feel his energy. I never really had great intuition growing up. I made a lot of mistakes by not following, or not a great ability to follow my intuition. Just not getting a gig for not doing one thing, even though I knew I should have done that. I now get answers so clearly. And they're immediate. Like I'll reach out with some sort of question, you know, and they're like clear and not even in my personality. So maybe I had that ability that I didn't know. But, you know, it's all I have. And I love it, you know. I love that I feel I'm being visited.
We end the same way each time. By the way, the quote's going to be on the website. And I'm excited that the respond, don't react. Right? Did I quote it correctly?
Can I give my second quote? Are we still rolling?
We're still rolling.
My second quote is actually going to be the... I guess it's a bit of a plug. I wasn't planning on doing it, but being a songwriter and a person who owns a studio and can record and write and record his own music, when Nick left us, I got into his phone. I was able to see the whole pathology of his spiral. But then I went back further on when he was happy, coupled with self-doubt. Then I opened up my journal, because I kept a journal for the last couple of years, and there was a correlation between the two. And I wrote 10 songs that is sort of the journey of those 5 years with Nick in the trenches. It's called Hold Still, Light Escape. The name of the body of work is Hold Still, Light Escapes. That would be my second quote. Just to sort of, you know, turn it down a notch, keep it together, keep the energy within you. So that's my second quote. And I hope that all proceeds will go to the Nick Pagano scholarship. People can contact me at info@richpagano.com. That's info@rich, P as in Peter, AGANO.com.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for being here. I felt really, really inspired from your words, your story, and all the people that you're helping. Thanks so much for being here. And folks, I want to thank you for listening. Without you, we have no podcast. Remember to subscribe and like, give us your comments. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time.